Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Liz Cunningham, has always loved being in or near the water, swimming, paddling, scuba diving, or just walking on the beach. A year after a near-death experience while kayaking on the California coast, Liz decided to get back into the water, become a dive master, and explore the underwater world. She started her journey by going back to a place she loved the most, the Turks and Caicos Islands. A conversation with a man who had been diving all over the world changed her life. He told her that the sea they were enjoying is like a little pristine pocket of life that survived. He said to the north in the Bahamas and to the south in the Dominican Republic, the reefs are thrashed. Might as well enjoy it while you can. She had to do something. Liz decided to travel to four of the most beautiful spots on the planet and learn about the state of the seas. Along the way, she met conservationists, fishermen, sea nomads, and scientists. And she writes about her journey in her new book, Ocean Country, One Woman's Journey from Peril to Hope in Her Quest to Save the Seas. Liz Cunningham has worked as an editor and writer for over 15 years. Her writing has appeared in many publications, including the San Francisco Chronicle, the Outward Bound International Journal, and the Marin Poetry Center Anthology. And Liz Cunningham joins me in studio. Hi, Liz. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Rose.
It's great to have you. What a journey this has been for you.
Well, actually, it's continuing.
Yes, of course. I mean, you used to be a hardcore political reporter right in the thick of things and then decided to leave that world to spend more time in the ocean.
Yes.
And you, this book is so intimate. I love underwater life, so I loved your book so much. It's a very intimate book about the oceans and our interaction with this vast body of water. And you begin the book by writing about a kayaking accident that completely changed your life.
Yes.
Tell us
did.
About that.
Well, I, you know, I was very outdoorsy. And I was out surfing the waves out here on the Pacific coast, and I was hit by a rogue wave and had a concussion. And then I came to, and when I came to, I was upside down, and my head was facing the bottom of the ocean. And in order to release yourself from a whitewater kayak, you need to pull on a neoprene spray skirt to get it out. I went to do that, and my arms had been paralyzed. My back was injured when I was hit by the rogue wave. So I was just flopping there like a rag doll, and my mind was thrashing like a fish in a bucket. I was just going, please, please, you know, anything. I'll do anything to get out of here. This can't be happening. I was, you know, bargaining, all this stuff. Finally, I thought, I can't believe this is happening. I'm really dying. I went away into a place. It wasn't a dream world because I couldn't see. Later, a psychologist friend said the last sense to go is hearing. I heard a voice ask me, do you want to live? I said, yes. And just when I said yes, it was like someone had turned on this strobe in a big stadium. And wham, I was back in this washing machine. My eyes bolted open and I had this painful tingling in my arms. I groped forward. I pulled the cord on the spray skirt and pushed myself out. And I was very lucky because I had a life preserver. I would not have been able to stay afloat, and I was wheezing and coughing water out of my lungs.
Mm. How did that change your relationship with the water?
I was terrified of it. For quite a while, I recall going back to the beach and putting one toe in the water, and it sent a ripple up my spine.
Wow.
But over time, I realized, you know, even though the ocean had almost dished me up his chum, I realized it said in relief, like this love affair, how much I loved it. So finally I said, okay, you got to deal with this fear and get back to the ocean that you really love.
And not only did you want to get back into the water, but you wanted to become a dive master.
Part of that was also to get some mastery over my presence in the water. And I felt like, you know, if you train, this is going to push you to calm down in the water. And it did.
And so you decided to go to the Turks and Caicos Islands in the Atlantic Ocean.
Yes.
And that's one of your favorite places.
It is. It's remarkable. Even I was talking to a colleague from Britain, Amdeep Sanghera, who actually I write about. And we were talking about it. And I said, God, I don't know what the problem is. Every time the airplane wheel hits a tarmac, I'm like, oh, I feel like I've broken a fast. There are two places in the world. One is here, the San Francisco Bay Area. And even after having been to the Coral Triangle, there's something about that little tiny sand strip of island that really pulls at my heart.
What does it look like?
Coming in from the air, it's really people either are totally in love with it or they just don't even know why you're bothering with it. But it's just some little sand strips in the middle of these remarkable swirls of turquoise and deep turquoise green and then a very deep violet blue trench that drops off where the Atlantic drops off to about 11 or 12,000 feet. So these remarkable swirls, part of it is the beautiful turquoise, but part of it's the feel of the wind on your skin. There's this ever-present moving wind.
And tell us where it is exactly.
Just north of Haiti and the Dominican Republic.
And so when you were snorkeling, or diving, I should say, yeah. You had another life-changing event. You met a man who is a retired pilot, mm-hmm. and he has been diving all over the world to some of the most beautiful spots on the planet. And he said that you were both enjoying this little pristine pocket of life that has survived.
Yeah, and, you know, we were on the boat. And then, you know, what he said, you know, he said, well, might as well enjoy it while you can. As if this is not going to last. And I remember saying, you don't think there's any hope for it or for the oceans? And he said, nah, it's a goner. And I remember saying, I tried to temper my pessimism with a grain of salt. I said that to him, and he said, well, you have to be pragmatic. And that evening I was in the bathroom. I was putting my contacts on, and God, that guy had gotten my goat. I thought, why are you so livid at this man? And I looked in the mirror, and I was putting on these contacts, and I thought, is it him or is it me? Because sometimes when I'm upset at somebody, I always think, well, what is it about me that this is telling me? And I thought, well, am I going to just enjoy it while I can? And that was a real turning point that I thought, wow, what am I doing?
At that point, did you know just the level of danger that the reefs are in and the fact that so many reefs are vanishing? Did you know?
I had absolutely no idea. But one of the important things about that, and I speak about this often, is that if you asked me at that time, do you understand the damage we're doing to the planet? I would say, hey, I'm very informed. I read the New York Times. I know what's happening. And if you'd pushed me, I would have pushed back. And I said, no, I know. But not the way I do now after seeing so much.
Even though you've spent so much time in the water.
Yeah. I mean, what I'm saying is that before I spent that much time, I would have told you I do because right. I've read X number of articles and so forth. But now I know it so much more deeply, the consequences. But even now, I'm aware there's so many levels and layers I probably still am not aware of. Mm.
So then you did a lot of research. You read the reports.
Yes.
Like we see the headlines on a regular basis, and it's very dire. Mm. And throughout the book, you ask this question, which I'll ask you later on in the show because we often ask ourselves this. Yeah. What do I do? What do I do with this kind of grief?
Yeah. Well, the place that really came up was I began exploring opportunities to write about ocean conservation, and I went back to the Turks and Caicos Islands, and I was doing interviews, and I was there in June of 2012, and I had started to really develop a relationship with this reef. And within a week's time, the best way to tell you this was there was a spot on that reef called Boneyard. It was a site, and I'd gotten very attached to it, and it was an incredibly beautiful site where there was just, you know, you would go down and there maybe be 100 different kinds of fish all darting in and out of coral. And I was there 1 week, and it was just extraordinary. There were damselfish and breams and snapper, and went back a week later, jumped off the end of the boat, took a deep breath, went down, and I go, they've put me in the wrong site. I don't know where I am. And I looked, and I was like, oh, wow, the sand channels are here. But it was unrecognizable. And it had bleached, and all the fish were gone. And that exact week, NOAA had recorded a 4-degree spike in North Atlantic surface temperatures. And what I didn't know 10 years before was how fast an ecosystem can collapse.
Hmm. Can you elaborate on that a bit? I mean, 4 degrees, can you explain how that works?
Sure, yeah. And, you know, I remember even jumping in the water and going, gosh, it's warm. Hmm. But, you know, on your dive computer you have it, but they also recorded it. It had gone up from 78 to 82. And the coral in the Caribbean is not built for 80-degree water or 82-degree water. Some of the coral in Southeast Asia is, but not in the Caribbean, especially the hard coral.
And so 4 degrees, though, a lot of people would say, how did that happen in a week?
Yeah, it's remarkable. Currents. We have it here as well. You know, when a different current of water comes in and moves, we have a warm blob now out in the Pacific. We certainly experience that. A lot of people ask me, so 4 degrees, what's the problem? But just take the human body and you go up from 100 to 104. Doesn't work. Mm.
What I find fascinating about the ocean is that most people, probably the overwhelming majority of the population, has never been underwater.
Yes.
And so when you hear that the ocean is in trouble, it's hard to understand what that means, because those of us who are lucky enough to live by the beach look at the beach and think, it's gorgeous, it's beautiful. What do you mean it's in trouble?
Yeah, yeah. And I think for myself personally, for many years before I got involved in ocean conservation, my first time snorkeling or diving under the water, what happened was it revealed this parallel world with huge canyons, and instead of rainforests, there were kelp forests and these massive canyons of coral. It was a parallel world, but also a world which we need. For instance, in terms of our breath, there's over 50% of the oxygen in every breath we take comes from marine plants and algae. Well, it's actually, some estimates are 70 or 80%. The scientists just don't want to overstate it. But we are so dependent on a healthy ocean. It's a life support system.
Talk about the importance of coral reefs. You write that they're in terrible danger from anchoring damage, overfishing, divers kicking delicate coral heads that take years to regrow, and nutrient runoff, that miserable hodgepodge of sewage, fertilizers, and other chemicals that are pumped into the rivers and the oceans on a daily basis.
So coral reefs are actually a very small area of the ocean. So when people, for instance, we're having a mass global bleaching right now, and people go, well, that'll be all right, it'll recover, and it's not that much. When you do the math, though, with species, in some areas, it's 70% of all marine species spend some portion of their lifespan in a coral reef. So when you pull that out, it's like pulling out a whole chunk of their life, and they need that ecosystem in order to survive. So when these coral reefs are collapsing, it's a tremendous impact on fisheries.
Because the fish leave when the coral bleaches and they look for healthier terrain, but scientists really don't know how far they go or where they go.
We think they go deeper. We're not really sure. Mm.
And so how does that affect? I mean, that affects the whole ecosystem.
It does, absolutely. One of the things, people think very often that coral is stony, because when they see it above water, they think of coral as a stone. But in fact, they have little tentacles and they actually mate. They breed on the full moon and they have stomachs. And that's one reason why it feels so tremendously alive when you're in a healthy coral reef. You're actually surrounded by tiny, tiny animals. That's why it feels so alive. And then when you see a bleached coral reef, that's why it feels so dead.
Because in some cases, if you're lucky, the coral will be vibrant.
Yes.
Purples, blues.
Yes.
And then when it's dead, it's very brown.
Brown. It is. It's very brown. Yes.
It almost feels like like there's bones that are sort of laying on the seafloor.
Yeah. And that, you know, coral reef just keeps growing. You know, they die and then that creates this kind of cathedral-like armature. And then, you know, at the surface you have the live coral. And if you see them at night, you can see the little tentacles come out. It's pretty remarkable.
You write that in the Caribbean, scientists have documented an 80% loss of hard coral over the last three decades. The problems are so massive and so in need of international coordination that paralysis is often the reaction.
Yeah, it is. One of the things that was so striking, I mean, this was just such an incredible adventure physically. It had so many surprises. One of the things that shocked me was the level of grief at what happened. But this sweet pie in my face was that in remarkable linkage of people all around the world working to do something like this. For instance, in Southeast Asia, I met a small-scale fisherman, people who were poor by our measure, and they had decided not to dynamite fish. And in their specific area, there had been a 75% reduction in dynamite fishing, and fish were coming back. And what's happening there? People are taking responsibility for their own lives and their communities, and they're taking action. So the other thing was, there was all this bad news, but then there was all this courage and all this dignity and people really taking their power back.
You met a man who would basically dynamite fish.
Yes.
And he decided to stop doing that. Can you first off, for people who don't know this, how this process works, can you explain it?
It's horribly dangerous. There are large-scale operations that bring dynamite down from a big boss in Singapore, and the dynamite and the fish run through organized crime networks that also run narcotics. There are also small-scale operations. It's either a bundle of dynamite or a homemade bomb that's made with fertilizer. But either way, the game gets played. It's usually one of these small fishermen that's hired to do the job. They stand at the bow of the boat. You light the fuse. You have to have that fuse be short enough that it's going to go off before it hits the water. But it has to be long enough that it doesn't blow up in your hands. And it has blown up in many hands. I talked to a dynamite fisherman, a former dynamite fisherman, and a friend had lost an arm. Another had lost vision in one eye. It's incredibly dangerous.
I'm speaking today with Liz Cunningham about her new book, Ocean Country, One Woman's Journey from Peril to Hope in Her Quest to Save the Seas. Liz traveled to four of the most beautiful spots on the globe. She talked to conservationists, scientists, fishermen about what they're facing and what the oceans are facing. And so many people had the same messages for Americans. The fish have been overexploited and the reefs are vanishing and the time to act is now. So if you have any questions for Liz about what she found, we'd love to hear from you. If you work on these issues, if you're an ocean lover, what questions do you have about the state of the oceans and the changes that need to be made? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Can you tell us a little bit more about the man you met who was bombing fish and why he decided to stop?
Sure. One of my favorite people to talk about is Ansi Wahab, who headed up with his friend a fisherman's collective in Wanchi, which is in the southeast Sulawesi. And all the fishermen in these collectives had agreed not to dynamite fish. And they had tremendous dignity. They said, "We do this for our children. We do this so they will have fish to eat." But it was only when I spoke with a fisherman anonymously who had walked away from it that he explained the linkage to organized crime. And then I understood that these fishermen had tremendous pride and dignity, and that dynamite fishing paid per day $85 to $170. If you use sustainable methods, it was $4 to $40. So these fishermen had such a big impact on me because I felt like they are doing so much. I have so many resources. So these guys just kind of blew me away, and I think that they really reset my clock because I understood how much I could use my voice and use all the resources available to me because they were doing so much with so little and then choosing a huge pay cut.
And you always asked most of the people you interviewed, what message would you like me to bring back home?
Yes.
And what did they tell you?
There were many of them, and it was a remarkable experience. One of them was from a fisherman in another fisherman's collective on the island of Tomia, and I was with a group of villagers there. And I have to tell you, when we would sit and people would gather and their eyes would look at me, I remember asking them, "Has anyone come to your village and asked you how things are going?" "No, never." And so to be asked this question, you feel very freighted with the weight of it. And I asked, "Is anything I can tell you, tell people when I would go back to the United States?" And they said, "Please tell people to eat sustainable fish. It's not cheap. It costs more. But if we don't do this, if we're not willing to do this, there are not going to be any fish left in the sea."
You report that 75% of major marine fish stocks were either depleted, overexploited, or being fished to their limit. Stocks of large fish, cod, grouper, marlin, swordfish, tuna, have already fallen 90% since 1950.
Yes.
Sylvia Earle, the amazing diver conservationist, doesn't eat fish anymore because of all of this.
Yeah.
What do you think about that choice?
You know, I don't eat very much. Line caught somewhere nice. My husband will catch trout that's been stocked in a reservoir, and I love that. But if you want to eat fish on the Pacific coast, halibut line caught is great, striped bass. So I think it's important to support fishermen who are doing it right. Mm. So on the one hand, you could say, yeah, you know what, I don't want to eat fish. But there are a lot of fishermen out there who are really making an effort to do it right. And the marine protected area system that we have in California that was really formed in collaboration with fishermen here who really understood they wanted to continue the tradition, they've done a great job and they shouldn't be demonized.
And what is the best way to go about finding that? I mean, the aquarium down in Monterey has their sustainable fish pamphlet. What else? What other advice would you give to people?
We just whip out our cell phones and download the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch app. And then when you're in the grocery store, wham, you just whip that out and type in what you're looking at.
We are after the break, we'll talk about the Coral Triangle, which stretches from Indonesia to Malaysia, the Philippines, and the Solomon Islands. And when you were there, you were taken to what is called a fish factory.
Yes.
And this kind of blew your mind.
Yes. Well, I arrived late at night, after midnight, and we were driving from Manado in North Sulawesi. And I remember this had been quite a long trip to get there, you know, a couple airplanes. And I'd fallen asleep in the car. And when I woke up, I asked the driver, I said, what's that? 'Cause it looked like a prison. And he said, fish factory. And then we drove by another one that looked like a prison with this barbed wire and strange windows and fish factory. And then we got to a very dingy dock at night, and a small boat came to meet me to take me to a very small lodge. And all of a sudden, all the numbers that I had been reading, you know, 20,000 or 200,000 tons of fish here and fish there, all these numbers, I could finally see them. Because we motored in this tiny boat through this harbor, and they were these container ships full of frozen tuna, and they were like skyscrapers. You're just motoring along and you're going, okay, I think I get the numbers now. They were literally like buildings. And then you saw large factory ships, these ships that have freezers, and you know they actually prepare the fish on the boat, and then small fishing boats. So suddenly the numbers really started to kick in.
20,000 tons of fresh and frozen tuna was exported by Indonesia to Japan in 2010, 13,000 tons to the U.S. You write, the numbers defied imagination.
Yes, yes. So, you know, when you're in the grocery store, make some noise. For instance, I remember being in Whole Foods in Walnut Creek in 2010, and they had Atlantic bluefin tuna out for sale. And I remember I looked at that, and I went to the customer service line, and I said, I'd like to file a complaint. And they kind of were like, okay. And they gave me a piece of paper, and I wrote on the piece of paper, how could you serve this species of fish? It's endangered. It's on the verge of being extinct. And I remember I was not in a good mood, so I said, if you do, why don't you have an endangered species aisle with frozen panda bear legs? I was not in a good mood. But then I walked away feeling powerless and helpless, you know, going home. But that year, Whole Foods stopped buying Atlantic bluefin tuna. And the fact that large mega retailers, Whole Foods, Costco, Carrefour in Europe, bluefin tuna actually started coming back in the years that followed. And you never know if all these little efforts can add up. At the moment, I felt silly, but looking back, all these petitions, awareness campaigns, social media campaigns, moratoriums, protests, they actually added up. And it was similar with humpback whales, who would have gone extinct in the 60s.
Liz Cunningham is author of the new book, Ocean Country, One Woman's Journey from Peril to Hope in Her Quest to Save the Seas. Liz traveled to four of the most beautiful spots on the globe to find out what people are facing, what the oceans are facing. And so many people wanted to send this message. The fish have been overexploited, the reefs are vanishing, and the time to act is now. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation today on Your Call. You can go on the telephone, you can go send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you may go to yourcallradio.org, the website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by telephone, call us toll-free 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Coming up in a half an hour at 11 o'clock, it's World Have Your Say from the BBC. They'll be talking about the Iowa caucuses.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about the unfolding San Francisco political corruption scandal, an FBI investigation of a Bay Area organized crime ring headed by Raymond Shrimpboy Chow has implicated several public employees and officials, including three former fundraisers for San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee. So how deep does this corruption scandal go? That is tomorrow, Thursday. We'll speak with Greg Jobin Leeds about his new book, When We Fight, We Win, 21st Century Social Movements and the Activists That Are Transforming Our World. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. If you'd like to join us today, we're talking about saving the ocean. I mean, this is such a massive issue because we've got the over-exploitation of fish, coral reefs are vanishing, and then there was a report out earlier this week that got so much attention that found if we continue consuming like we do and using so much plastic, there will be more plastic in the oceans than fish by the year 2050. And then a listener this morning sent me another dire piece about how man-made pollution is affecting the ability of marine mammals like killer whales and dolphins to breed and may lead to the extinction of some species. This is according to international research published in Scientific Reports. So things are pretty dire. That is a fact. Today's guest, Liz Cunningham, went to four places around the globe to find out what needs to change, what action can we take. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Leon in Oakland. Hi, Leon. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I think it's an important issue. Thanks for doing this. I'm going to play a little bit of a devil's advocate here and ask, since ecosystems are always changing and evolving, and sort of by definition they include whatever's in them, if a species like the bluefin tuna goes extinct, aside from the economic implications and food implications, in a certain way, how much does it really matter? Or if the killer whales go extinct, for example?
Leon, I think that's a really important question, and I've asked it myself. And the way I go back to it is that it's telling us something about our life support system. So when that species goes extinct, it's a canary in the coal mine. But I think the other thing is, you know, I get up some mornings and I think, I don't know if I matter. And personally, I don't think I matter unless the bluefin matters. And I think that a species on this planet has a right to continue its life force.
Hmm. Well, we talked yesterday about saving the bees. And the main argument about this is the economic argument. Without the bees, we're not going to have fruits and vegetables, right? Yeah. And so some scientists said, well, what about the moral argument also?
Yeah, I understand what you're also saying, though, which is you think, well, so what? But it is telling us something about our world and what's happening to our world, that it's actually crumbling. But I also do feel that species have rights not to be rendered extinct by us.
Mm. And Paul Watson, the head of the Sea Shepherd Society, says without the ocean, we don't exist.
Yes, yes.
Well, thank you for that call, Leon. Let's go next to Ed in Berkeley. Hi, Ed. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. I'm wondering if the sea traffic that comes through, a tremendous amount of sea traffic, what effect that has on the fish, the big freighters. And I understand 80% of the pollution, the air pollution, is from the ocean-going vessels.
I'm not sure about that. I'm not an expert on that, but we do know that the amount of noise in the ocean is profoundly disorienting, and I don't think that we fully understand the effects of it, but we know that it affects navigation and it also affects breeding.
Thank you for the call, Ed. Let's go next to Marie-Louise in Palo Alto. Hi, Marie-Louise.
Good morning, and thank you. And thank you for having programs that matter and that enlighten people, hopefully. So what I wanted to say was I heard a couple of weeks ago that I have to say that what I read actually was that there were Chinese fishermen who were really basically destroying coral reefs to get to giant clams because they had to destroy a lot of the coral reefs in order to reach these very big, and they said they could be up to 150 years old, and the meat in the clam apparently just gives a lot of money. They get a lot of money for it. So that's one little point, if I could say that. And the second is, can anyone help me understand what where the Chinese that are making island out in the ocean, where do they get the material to make the islands? Because it seems you got to scrape it from somewhere in order to put it in big heaps to make islands. So that's a lot, but that's what I had to say, and I'd be very interested in what you think and what you know.
Marie-Louise, these are both two very important things. I don't know where they extract that material to put that island together, but I can't imagine that that's done in a sustainable way. I think that's a very strange enterprise. In regard to the clams, I think it's really important to be bringing this up and for us all to be looking at what we eat and what we buy, because these foods are considered to be a delicacy, like something fantastic and wonderful, but they're actually really the result of tremendous damage. So it's a wonderful point that you're making, Marie-Louise.
We have a number of emails about the state of the ocean. Philip writes, isn't it that nature makes mistakes but can also self-correct? Perhaps human nature, being what it is compatible with the natural environment and is becoming more so as the population grows. Perhaps the solution for nature's evolutionary mistake is for nature to rid herself of the problem, namely humans, and the process of doing so will come about when the environment becomes too toxic for human life.
You want me to respond to that? Well, I think that I'm glad to respond to that, because I think a lot of people do just feel that way and they become hopeless, and that this is really a hopeless situation. I think that for myself personally, how I deal with these thoughts is, if I had, you know, I don't have children, but my cousins have children. And if I saw one of these kids in front of a bus, I'd leap in front of that bus to save them. And I think that the way I see it is for us to get more in touch with our deepest instincts about who we are and how we live, and then to take those deep instincts and begin to work with the world around us. And for me, that's the passion for rescue. And on an instinctual basis, I am just simply unable to accept that kind of outcome. I would prefer to make my best effort and then let the chips fall where they may.
And you did a lot of work around this, right? Because
yes.
You have felt some very deep grief.
Yeah. I mean, it's very easy to say it's going to go to hell. If you really want to do something to support large corrupt corporate interests, and you want to support politicians who don't give a damn about the people, I think that it's greatly to their benefit for us to feel hopeless and to think that our actions don't matter.
We have an email from a sophomore student in college, Liz, who is studying environmental policy. Her dream is to be an ocean conservationist. And she says, do you have advice about how to get involved in ocean conservation organizations you think are doing in particularly important work? What marine issues demand the most attention right now from current and future conservationists?
Well, Liz, I've often asked myself that question and come up with different answers. The first thing I'd advise is look into your heart. What do you care about most? What most fascinates you? Because that's what you're going to stick with and make the most difference. Then find the people who are working on that issue. And for me, my answer was people in the developing world, and that took me to sustainable seafood. But there are fantastic people working on marine plastic. They're working on turtles. So whatever captivates you, go with that and follow that thread.
Well, in order to ensure that she becomes an environmentalist, because we need you, Ingrid, can you give us a few more positive stories that you ran across? You have some really good stories here about how people are trying to save mangroves.
Yes. These are terrific stories. In the Turks and Caicos, I went and interviewed a number of people and shadowed them as they did work. And there are a number of people who are restoring mangrove habitats. And this is incredible work. And these people, Marcia Pardee and Eric Salamanca, were two people that headed up a mangrove replanting program. But mangroves are incredibly important. They are 50 times more powerful carbon sinks than Amazon rainforest. So they are really important to dealing with climate change. But they're also nurseries for juvenile fish, and they also protect the coastline. And you can replant them. But these people, you know, they did tremendous work and they worked against the odds, but they were also supported by an enormous number of volunteers. I was just in North Sulawesi last summer, and a very, very small village was granted some money from the national park. And what did they do? They didn't want satellite dishes. They replanted 2,000 mangroves to restore their coastline.
You also have stories about how locals are fighting development. They're fighting the cruise industry. They're fighting these massive hotels that come to their little villages. You've got a story about what happened in South Caicos. You spoke with marine ecologist Marsha Pardee, and she told you that the government and developers wanted to build a Dubai-style artificial island. She said, you know, multi-million-dollar homes, a luxury hotel, a marina. The then premier of the Turks and Caicos Islands, Michael Misik, who would later be brought up on corruption charges and eventually have a warrant put out on him, had signed off on the project without any public notice or debate. And I think this is important because a lot of people go on these cruises, they go to these beautiful resorts, and really don't know the backstory about how they got there.
Yeah, and it's very important to think about how, when you go on vacation, how are things handled behind the scenes in terms of waste management and also like what money is being paid off for the land that you're on, anything like that. One of the most amazing things about that story, though, was that they started to create this Dubai-style island in the middle of a harbor, and they destroyed a large area. But then a group of conservationists, led up by Marsha, they went and replanted mangroves. And there was this great truth that surfaced with that, and that is begin again, start over. The other piece was they were ripping out this area, but they were petition signed all over the world to stop it, and they were able to stop it, even though this was insanely corrupt.
Liz Cunningham is out with a new book about her journey around the globe called Ocean Country, One Woman's Voyage from Peril to Hope in Her Quest to Save the Seas. Liz has been an editor and writer for over 15 years. She used to write about politics, and now she's dedicating her life to saving the oceans and raising awareness about these very important issues. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. 8255. If you're involved in these issues in California, we'd love to hear from you. What are you currently working on? What concerns you? What questions do you have for Liz? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Ingrid, thank you again for your email. Let's go next to Linda in San Francisco. Hi, Linda. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. And thank you for your incredible value of programming.
Thank you.
And especially about this. I wanted to bring up the fact that you had also talked about sand wars a while back.
Right.
And the impact that that has on the oceans and these reefs and habitats and how these islands appear. And that might be that answer is the sand wars.
Yeah, we did a show about a documentary focusing on sand wars where they're taking sand from one part of the world and then sending it to another part of the world because certain parts of the world are running out of sand. They're just using too much.
Yeah, I mean, I also watched that documentary, and we got some sandbags for El Nino, and some of them were worn out, and we thought, well, can we put these worn out ones in new bags? Because you just think, where does this sand come from? The other thing that I looked for is there are also some inflatable sandbags now that you can get that you can actually pump water in. But when you think about replacing something or building something, very often there's some sand taken from some area, and it's not replaced. It takes millions of years to create that sand.
Well, thank you for the phone call. We have an email from John who says the Chinese are building islands on reefs in the Pacific Ocean and small fishermen are destroying the reefs by breaking them up to get giant clams and turtles for the shells. It's total destruction. Amy writes in and says she thinks sustainable seafood is a myth.
Amy, I think that's a very important attitude because some of it is. A lot of it isn't, though. When these fisheries are certified, they certify every stage that the seafood goes through from the fisherman to the auction to the wholesaler and then the retailer. There are certainly grave failures in the system, but sustainable seafood is definitely more sustainable than seafood that's not sustainable at all. At one point in Makassar, a survey was done in Sulawesi in the market in Makassar, I think it was in the late 90s, and over 70% of the fish that went through that huge port and all the fish that went into the cargo containers was from dynamite fishing. If you choose sustainable seafood, that percentage is going to go down. It's not perfect, but it's going to be better. And I think that one thing that's very important is that sustainability is a journey. So, all right, this isn't perfect, but let's choose better over worse.
What did you learn in France when you spent a lot of time talking with people there about sustainable fish and what it's like to try to educate people on this topic?
One of the most important things is that in order to create change, you need a network. You need a linkage of people to do it. And the sustainable seafood chain really sets this in relief. In order for seafood to be sustainable, then every linkage in the chain, from the ocean to the fork, every one of those people needs to be a part of that chain. And it really set in relief for me what social change looks about, how that looks. And that is that everybody has a role to play. Everybody needs to be engaged in it because we all feel so helpless. We think, oh, my God, how can I do something? And one of the big pieces of it is start connecting with people about something that you care about. Start forming linkages. And even if you don't see how it's going to add up, don't quit. Because many of the biggest changes that have been created in civil rights or in women's rights, these movements aren't perfect, but a lot of those changes happened because people linked up and they didn't quit.
Liz Cunningham is author of Ocean Country, One Woman's Voyage from Peril to Hope and Her Quest to Save the Seas. And if you'd like to join us, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. If you have any questions for Liz about what she found on her journey, if you work on ocean conservation, what are you working on? What do you think actually works? What concerns you the most right now? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Harvey. Hi, Harvey. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Harvey.
Thank you, Rose. And hello, Liz. Thank you for the good work. I'd like to talk about power plants. They have something called once-through. Like the Diablo Canyon nuclear power plant has a once-through system. It takes in 2.5 billion gallons of water, seawater a day to cool the two reactors, and then puts it out 20 to 25 degrees hotter. And at the same time, they kill billions and trillions of fish. It's been going for 30 years now. They kill the larvae and animals get caught against the screens. They can't escape. And I believe that this thermal pollution is actually heating up the oceans because there's thousands of these plants around the world sucking in ocean water and putting it out hotter. And they've been going on for years, every day, 24 hours a day, year in, year out.
I think it's very possible. And I also think that nuclear power is inefficient. I mean, we've got this incredible reactor in the sky, you know, sunrise to sunset. Why do we need this elaborate and dangerous process?
Well, thank you for calling in, Harvey. What about change in the political structure and laws? What are your thoughts on that? I mean, we're having a debate about climate change in this country, and there's so much activism on the ground to raise awareness about all of these issues.
It's growing slowly. It is growing, though. I think that a lot of people are just hitting the snooze button, like we had the climate summit, and then, okay, wham, hit the snooze button again. Every time an extreme weather event happens, it spikes up, but there is still a huge denial about the enormity of the issue. What's remarkable is that every day there are new things happening that will help us to deal with this. The most important thing is to connect with other people about the issue and also in your communities, thinking about what can I do in my community. But our democracy has gotten kind of sleepy. So I sign petitions every day. I think it still does matter. The microbead ban in California was petition-driven. People think, oh, that won't matter. It doesn't matter if I don't make noise. However, I will say that even though I knew about climate change a decade ago, it took all of this for me to decide last November to go out and march in a rally. And at that point, I realized this is about going out into the street and showing up.
What was it that really changed you? Because you changed your perspective about the future and the urgency of a response to climate change pretty drastically.
The damage. And then the simple fact that it's not simply the fact that we're on the verge of the greatest environmental catastrophe. This is also about the greatest humanitarian catastrophe. There's 2.6 billion people all around the world who depend on seafood as their primary source of protein. If you factor in climate change, well, that doesn't mean necessarily they're going to have rice because we're going to have more droughts, more food shortages. The enormity of this damage, travel really drove it home. We have a lot of terrific conservation programs in place. Getting out of California and getting especially into Asia and seeing the enormity of the damage, but also the enormity of the extraction industry, these huge mines. There's a mine in Papua that you can see. It's so big, a gold and copper mine. You can see it from space.
And also, I mean, not only are the locals dealing with depleted fish supply, but so many don't have access to clean water.
Exactly. The UN, United Nations statistics now, it's 1,400 children per day that die because of some water-related disease.
Whenever there's a big climate conference like Paris, Copenhagen, there's so much amazing activism from these small countries, small villages. They dominate the conferences
yes.
for the most part.
Yeah.
I mean, if you do your homework and you read about the activism,
yes.
those are the people that you see
yes.
and the voices that you hear. Do you feel like their voices are being heard in terms of the decision-making process? Because it seems like it's getting louder and louder every year.
Well, it was very interesting to me personally, coming back from Southeast Asia, how I would deal with the humanitarian crisis that I saw unfolding. And it is not necessarily always included in conservation dialogue. This voice is getting louder and louder, and I certainly felt personally that this was a very large decision, that I couldn't turn my back on this issue. And at the same time, it's very important. Species have rights to exist apart from us. But I don't think that people, many times they just don't have the stomach to deal with this. It is so vast. This humanitarian crisis that's already starting to unfold is much larger than what we would have seen through the Great Depression and World War II. It's ahead of us. Well, you walk away and you say, there's nothing I can do. Every day there are going to be lives that can be saved, and every life matters.
What are you doing from here on out? Because you've done all of this research, and now you're trying to raise awareness about these issues, and you're getting phone calls from people saying, what do I do about
yeah,
this?
Yeah. In my own life, it's two and threefold. You know, a lot of people say, oh, where are you going to go travel off to next? And, you know, it's the journey led me here to this microphone in this day, in this studio with you. So me, myself, I get up every morning and I just ask the same question, what if I lived as if my voice mattered? Certainly politically as well, I feel responsible now to bring the voices of other people into the public domain. I visited with some sea nomads in Sulawesi, and when I left the village, I asked the chief of the village, what would you like me to tell people? And the sea nomads have lived nomadically or in these small stilled villages they've lived that way for 10,000 years. And he said, please tell people we need to take care of the ocean because the ocean is our home. We have no land. The ocean is our home. My job now is to take their voices out and be in the world as a voice, especially because of how urgent these issues are.
The other thing I wanted to talk to you about, we have just a couple more minutes, is what sounds to me like one of the most beautiful spots on the planet, the Coral Triangle.
Yes.
Can you just talk a little bit about what it was like underwater there?
It was, for me, probably the closest in certain areas that had not been damaged. It was, for me, perhaps a chance to go be underwater in what would have been the closest place to what the oceans were like hundreds of years ago. And I remember just feeling swept away in a magnetic force field, and it felt like it was raining fish. I couldn't even see the coral because the ocean was so dense with life. And I was sort of rush hour traffic, and I'd be in one school and then another school would come. And the sheer volume of life was just overwhelming. It gives me great joy to get up and serve that kind of beauty every day. And even though I have to deal with hugely disturbing facts, I feel extremely happy to be doing this job now.
And what did locals in that part of the world, the Coral Triangle, which again stretches from Indonesia to Malaysia, the Philippines, and the Solomon Islands, what messages did they have for you to bring back home?
It's very simple. There's not enough food to eat because there's less fish. And there's not enough fresh water.
Liz Cunningham is author of the book Ocean Country, One Woman's Voyage from Peril to Hope and Her Quest to Save the Seas. Liz decided to travel to four of the most beautiful spots on the planet and learn about the state of the seas after she met a diver who said to the north in the Bahamas and to the south in the Dominican Republic, the reefs are trashed. You might as well enjoy it while you can. So Liz is traveling to these beautiful spots, interviewing conservationists and fishermen and bringing their message home to us. Liz, thank you so much for sharing your journey.
It's great to be on your show, Rose.
Thank you. And thank you for your phone calls and emails. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Jor Call, we'll discuss the unfolding San Francisco political corruption scandal. An FBI investigation of a Bay Area organized crime ring headed by Raymond Shrimpboy Chow has implicated several public employees, including three former fundraisers for San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee. From bribery to money laundering, the charges have already ensnared former State Senator Leland Yee and political consultant Keith Jackson. So how deep does this corruption scandal go? It's Jor Call with me, Rose Aguilar. And you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
As KLW begins its 75th year on the air, we invite you to make 2016 the year that you become a member of local public radio. Just click the donate button at klw.org. World Have Your Say from the BBC is coming up next. It was recorded an hour earlier for broadcast now on your local public radio station. KALW San Francisco at 91.7, online at kalw.org. It is 11 o'clock.
Hello, this is World Have Your Say on the BBC. I'm Ben James, and this is the one clear winner from the Iowa caucuses.
Iowa has sent notice that the Republican nominee and the next president of the United States will not be chosen by the Washington establishment.
And that's Ted Cruz. He was the man who got the most backing from Republican voters in the state. He beat Donald Trump, who had led the polls. Marco Rubio celebrated his third place, pulling away from the rest of the pack. For the Democrats, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders were more or less tied. Well, we'll speak to supporters of all five of these now leading candidates over the next hour, not just in Iowa, but from across the country. Why is their man or woman the one they're backing, and how do they see the race